Lord Denning's report on the circumstances leading up to and surrounding the Profumo affair was presented last month to the English Parliament by the Queen's command. The report takes the form of a letter addressed to Mr. Macmillan. Here is Bernard Mays to present a general English review of the conclusions which Lord Denning came to.
There was a time when skeletons could be kept under lock and key in the Gothic West Wing, destined later to be bricked up forever or even unaccountably burnt down. But things are different nowadays. Today the truth manages somehow to insinuate itself between the cracks in whatever public statements may be made, unclothed, certainly unvarnished, and even sometimes nude. And so it happened only recently to one of Her Majesty's most trusted ministers, and that the influential Minister for War, and is in the most satisfactory episodes of the past, and no doubt in the future too. It's the sense of guilt which propels the wanton onto the stage to dandle its intimacies before the public eye, which, uneasy and green with envy, boggles at the comparison with its own. Once dandled, this particular intrigue, clad excitingly in a bikini, or dancing nymph-like most fittingly among the relics of Cliveden, deserved, as even her most shocked detractors agreed, to be investigated in greater detail. And investigated she has been. Not by the bold and brassy magazine, nor even by a royal commission sitting in session, but by a single, experienced, and presumably impregnable judge, experienced in law and impregnable in person. Miss Keeler deserved it. The crowd was not for her. Indeed, Lord Denning must have appeared a veritable fortress of respectability to the Prime Minister. He could investigate in secret, indulge in whatever meanderings seemed appropriate. Lord Denning himself, well aware of the importance of the occasion, accordingly and reluctantly undertook to perform all the roles of justice rolled into one. He had to be, as he himself says, detective, inquisitor, advocate, and judge all at the same time. This indeed seemed proper, if illegal, since he soon found he was dealing with perverted tastes, and even sexual orgies of a revolting nature. Justice, though forced to attend, could be allowed at least to bow her head or look in the opposite direction. The skeletons, for there were more than one, had of course to be dismantled, so that the bones of the case could be tagged and laid before us. Such solemnity has been invoked, so many lives threatened, that it is surprising to find the separate parts together compose no monster at all, but even ordinary people like ourselves. Each bone is labelled neatly with titles like the Cliveden Weekend and its sequel, or the Westminster Confidential, or even the Cup of Tea, which seem the more sinister for being every day. Nonetheless, his lordship is fair, and is most reluctant to disclose that neither Lord Astor nor his lady friends saw anything indecent at all when Miss Keeler searched in vain for her clothes among the Cliveden shrubbery. His lordship even placed careful parentheses round the race of one of Dr. Ward's girlfriends. Certainly, as he writes to Mr. Macmillan, many delicate situations arose, at which news the Prime Minister must have held his breath. But his lordship was able to clarify certain complications. Miss Keeler, for example, appears to have tried extortion, but to have failed miserably. Dr. Ward had a personal hankering to paint a perhaps romantic portrait of Mr. Khrushchev. But perhaps worst of all, while mankind teetered towards annihilation, watching Russian gunboats head for the American blockade of Cuba, it was Dr. Ward who, with his influential friends, was privately trying to engineer a summit conference. It appears, too, that several people unaccountably left the scene at crucial moments in the unravelling. One, for instance, could be found shooting grouse on the Scottish Highlands. Another, Lord Astor himself, walked the streets of New York, while the Profumos plodded uneasily along the Venetian canals. Meanwhile, vast sums were paid to Christine, the News of the World, alone spent $69,000 on her. It's the security service which comes out healthy and unharmed. Answerable apparently to no one, another strange anomaly, they clearly didn't want to have anything to do with the case. The doctor was a decent fellow, though he talks too much and is possibly a procurer of popsies for rich people. If only the stage could have been left that way, but under the icy purity of public self into the Mediterranean night, and determined to face it out in England, booked a train and came back by boat, as a plane would have been too conspicuous. Neither could others escape. The Prime Minister had long secretly been informed ever since the rumours started to spread, and the coloured man's trial threatened to confirm them. Mr. Macmillan even had reported to him John Profumo's replies to the Chief Whip, who told Profumo there was no need to tell the Prime Minister, since in Mr. Macmillan's view there would be no turning back on a discussion at so high a plane. There was whispering in the chamber. One friend of Profumo's even said publicly, "He's a liar," when Profumo had denied anything but friendship for Miss Keeler. "They will never believe me," Profumo told the Chief Whip, "but it's true." It is the Chief Whip's care to look after the well-being of the party, and Mr. Profumo's reply was dutifully relayed to Mr. Macmillan. It was not enough that the War Minister had been warned, and that his association, a very close one, Christine continually returned to him, was dangerous and open to blackmail. Could he have foreseen the greater blackmail of public morality, which could cost the government so much? John Profumo lied about his love life, according to him, to protect his family, which is no doubt true enough. But lies are an insufficient fig leaf to protect the truth. Something more substantial had to be managed. Valuable training and wide experience in public affairs, a brilliant mind, must be sacrificed, abandoned, a government must totter, and perhaps even a suicide would together make a satisfactory compensation. Once an act is discovered to be criminal, there must be someone to blame for it, somewhere. But even his lordship found it difficult to apportion blame. He had armfuls of it, but who would wear it? A whole section of his letter is headed, "Was no one to blame?" "We are," he writes, "so anxious that neither the police nor the security service should pry into private lives, that there is no machinery for reporting the moral misbehaviour of ministers, and certainly the police must not go out to seek information about it, nor must the security service. But even if it comes incidentally to their knowledge, as it did here, there is no machinery laid down for reporting it. It is," his lordship goes on, "perhaps better thus than that we should have a police state. It is for the minister and his colleagues to deal with the rumour as best they can. It is their responsibility and no one else's." In the meantime, what of other overtones like "other ministers" or "Lord Astor's friends," to whom his lordship is forced to refer, but whom the spotlight has not yet seared? For there are surely many anxious men and women about in England today who once thought themselves safe. Miss Rice Davies, in her statement when she signed it, "The more rich and influential people I met, the more amazed I was at their private lives. Names who are household words take part in the most obscene things. It is these people whom the public eye may focus on next, despite Lord Denning, who wrote to his Prime Minister that since his concern was justice, it had nothing to do with him."
Bernard Mays was reviewing Lord Denning's report, presented by Queen Elizabeth's command, to the English Parliament after the Profumo affair last month.